This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and everybody. Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Tracy Morgan, and I am here today with Anna Fishson, who is a psychoanalyst and historian, and my firstborn New Books in Psychoanalysis host. She's on the program. We'll get back to why I'm referring to her as not a baby, but anyway, I've got a couple of thoughts about bringing on hosts. Anyway, so she's here on the program to share with us her thoughts about temporality as the interface with psychoanalysis, queer thinking, theory, childhood, all of which she pursued alongside Emma Lieber as they co-edited a volume called The Queer of Childhood. Uh-oh, what's that, Anna?
I can't turn off these notifications, but
Okay. Well, we're going to have notifications.
I tried very hard to turn them off.
Everybody. It's not. So back to the title of the book, The Queerness of Childhood, Essays from the Other Side of the Looking Glass, published by Palgrave and Macmillan. I want to sort of set things up in a certain way. So first of all, Anna is a dear friend, and I met her because of New Books in Psychoanalysis. So it was really, a wonderful byproduct of the channel. And I'm glad to have her here today because on an episode about time, I'm also going to call time. So this will be my last interview program, concluding a 13-year run that began with an analyst whose last name was Freud, Hendrika, no relation to Sigmund. And I wanted to begin with Freud, and I want to end in time, on time, if I can, facing reality, and with it, in a sense, mortality. Not that I'm dying, but, you know, like the end of something is a certain kind of death. I want to say a couple of words before we get into the meat and potatoes of the interview, Anna. So if you can just bear with me, because I want to say a couple of things to the audience, because they've been listening for a long time. 13 years listening for a long time. When I was doing New Books in Psychoanalysis, and while I've been doing it over these years, my sense of time was really impacted in some ways that have led to my wanting to step down because I want to have a different sense of time. I felt pressured sometimes to make the channel capture a wide array of thinkers in our field while they were still with us. And that clock was and is still ticking. And I also wanted, it was really important to me to bring on new hosts from various schools of psychoanalytic thought, such as yourself, Anna, you know, with your strong Lacanian background. And I wanted to add different voices of the project. I think I was thinking in ecumenical terms. I used to use that term a lot within a fractured field. I wanted to create an archive for the present and for the future, thinking of time that would enrich the field of psychoanalysis. And I also wanted to invest my time to promote the work of particularly clinical psychoanalysis. But given my character, each interview took a lot of time. And as time passed, I felt I was allotting my time to the work of others. And I had feelings about this, eventually envy and confusion, which is a defense against some other feeling we can figure out. But they made me sort of wonder about my own understanding of time, my own time. So I was always hoping to have this body of work of new books in psychoanalysis be reviewed by one of the big journals in the field, but I was unable to make that happen. That upsets me all the time. But I also want us to recall that 13 years ago, when this channel started, psychoanalysts were reluctant to speak into the ether, to the other, to the uninitiated. Many refuse interviews. I feel this is an important thing for people who are listening here to know. So for instance, we don't have Roy Schaefer or Philip Bromberg. They were asked, but they didn't want to do it. I mean, that was the case probably when you came on the channel too, Anna. There were still, people were right scared to kind of talk to
us. Also because people are afraid of exposing themselves to analysands or listening. So
right.
Watching the transcript. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, what this channel did was remarkable, I think, for its initial moment, unedited analytic thinking exposed to the public. And, you know, analysts make, you know, slips of the tongue or remarks that they were regretted, captured for all to see. You know what I mean? It's like the analyst is sort of this real person and our patients were listening, as you say. And so I think that this channel has existed reflects maybe a shift in the field also about like we are willing to live a little bit more in public and manage the transferences. That's kind of massive. I mean, to just note that change. Another thing I wanted just to say is that, you know, until very recently, New Books in Psychoanalysis was an unpaid endeavor. I hope you got paid, Anna. Did you get paid?
Of course not.
It's a labor of love. You have to say it was a labor of love, but now you can get money for all of your interviews that you did in the past. I have no idea.
Good to know. Thank you.
It's going to be enough money for we'll go out to dinner maybe or something. I don't know, just a little bit. But when I was thinking about time and money, and when money is not involved, the experience, how the experience of time changes. One author I interviewed, Lucy Holmes Orens, referred to New Books in Psychoanalysis as my baby. So that's why I call you my firstborn. locating my work in maternal time. Yeah, right, exactly. You are younger than me. And so, you know, I don't know how I could have managed, but I'm very happy to have you as a babe. You're great. How proud I am because you're so smart and so fun. She located my work in maternal time, right? Which maybe we'll talk about, the time of repetition, time of reproduction, let's do it again time, plug in the microphones, write the blurb, attend to the author's anxieties and promote the finished product on social media. Repeat, repeat, repeat. I'd like to thank Michael McAndrew and Mercer Greenwald who have been stalwart on that front. I also wanted to say another thing. Look, I've got a couple more things to say before we get into hearing from you. I hope you don't mind, but as this is my last time up, I did have grand plans for New Books in Psychoanalysis, and some of those dreams actually have been realized, which is a delight. We've developed a vast international listening audience, and the work of the School of Modern Psychoanalysis that I'm a part of has perhaps had more time in the sun or on the air than it ever had before, given that alongside myself, there's three other hosts, Isaac DeVries, Lexa Rosianne, Christopher Russell, who are also modern, who are hosts. And we have international hosts, Germany, England, the Ukraine, and India. Those are where some of our hosts are from. We have never had a Black host. I regret that, though, given the reorganization of the channel, which I want listeners to understand a little bit about. It may actually open up the door. Nepotism or, you know, white geography is kind of is a very real thing that makes breaking into something while Black often impossible. But I did spend a lot of time cultivating hosts over the years, seducing people to work for free. And also sometimes I vetted some hosts who seemed to me not quite right for the channel. And for a while we were a kind of group. Remember that? I mean, we used to meet, like have little meetings and stuff. Right, little meetings. And so I was looking for hosts who had been or still were in analysis. Because I thought that the quality of the interviews hinged on being emotionally tuned into the author's experience at some level, which I think has been something that people have commented on. I mean, you know, I know you've done interviews where, you know, we've had to help the author, right, to be ready, to prepare, to speak, to associate, to calm down, all that stuff.
Daunting, process, bring somebody to the interview.
Yeah. And you and I have had an incredible, terrible experience once that we couldn't publish. Remember that?
Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
By the way, only one.
But one was plenty. But you know, we met and we discussed at the time what we were doing, who we were going to interview, where we wanted the channel to go. You're so popular, all these people are emailing you. You know, and over time things have changed and I'm no longer able to cultivate a chosen group. So the channel has become more freeform, where people from outside of the once cultivated group can claim books. And this is true for listeners. I mean, you can think about doing this. You can decide that you want to do an interview and you can approach Marshall Poe and say that you'd like to do an interview and you can claim the book, which is fairly radical. But it also became something that like didn't give me as much pleasure because I liked to bring us together and to get us to think together about what we were doing. So like now we used to do 50 minute interviews and now they can be hours long. We have a lot of cross posts from psychology, self-help, Buddhism, and I am a fucking purist. Okay. So like, if you know, that's not my favorite thing, but I know that people like it as well. I guess just in closing, I wanted to let, Avgi Saketapolu know that she should be, and I believe will be interviewed by an analyst. And that's a whole other controversy, and I'm sure that this will get to her. And I want to thank Marshall Poe, head of the New Books Network, for trusting me to create this channel and to allow it to have a focus on psychoanalysis. About 14 years ago, he asked me to do a channel on psychology, and I said, I don't know anything about psychology. I'm pretty sure I know nothing about it, but I was very immersed in psychoanalytic thinking. He was a little hesitant and said, okay, go ahead. So over time, we have about 40,000 downloads a month or something like that. I leave New Books in Psychoanalysis knowing it has become one of the jewels of the New Books Network. And that's a very, very meaningful to me. And I wish it a long and prosperous time. I'm hoping to go on to create another podcast that's more about fun and irreverence and psychoanalysis and like less serious. That's kind of my dream.
Is to have some fun. Going to be thematic, Tracy?
I don't know. I mean, it could be, you know, like I do think that anything analysts do is kind of funny. Because we are like deformed in some ways and we're not, I always think we're not ready for polite company, you know, like given what we hear, you know. So I wanted, you know, I mean, even just like psychoanalysts go to the movies, it would be funny because we would say the most, you know, I mean, like the things that we talk about to each other, analysts tell all are, I think that we're deformed in a very beautiful way. As people, and you know, we have a sense of the absurd, pretty powerful. So anyway, thank you for that. Just for hanging with me during that, Anna, because I just wanted
sure.
to.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, well, it's just really nice for me to have you here for bringing things to.
I was a big fan of yours when the whole thing started, and then I became a host for a while, and it was a great time. So fitting here doing this together.
Absolutely. So I don't know, let's talk about time. I know you've always said to me, you know, well, I'm interested in temporality. I was like, it's time. That's what temporality means. I was like, okay, right. And, you know, you have this volume out, The Queerness of Childhood. You have an essay on, which I really loved, on the, on Brezhnev era, you know, Soviet Union cues and waiting on the cues and queue time, queer time. I mean, if you want to talk about that essay, that's fine. But I think more like you're a big thinker. I think you are.
Now I have to say something. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Say something big about time. Or no, so just, yeah, I'd like to, what are you thinking about time? Yeah, let's hear it.
What attracted me, I'll say this, what attracted me to the idea of queer time was, first of all, before I wrote this book, I wrote a book about opera. And as opera lovers know, in opera, time is very much stretched and it can be vertical as well as horizontal. There's a kind of narrative and the plot that goes in a linear way. And then there are sometimes, depending on the century of the opera's origin, there are cuts and there are arias. And it's more about a reflective, inward kind of looking time or temporality. And it feels kind of sacred. It's like it's not that time stops, but time is stretched and made extraordinary. And so there's like sort of quotidian time and this extraordinary time. And I'm very aware of this, or I've been aware of this for a long time. And then when I was working on late Soviet childhood and animation, I noticed that time was a big theme in these children, this culture seemingly made for children, but also always for adults, for a dual audience. As we know, children's culture often does address a kind of other audience and a nudge wink to a more adult audience. And especially, this was especially true in the Brezhnev period where there was a lot of censorship. State censorship disabled people in certain areas. Just, you know, you couldn't say everything in a so-called adult or you know, just like film, feature films, etc. So people worked in animation and could get things through in a kind of Aesopian language. But at any rate, there was this big theme of time, and I thought about why, and also this idea of time as being stretched, of being non-normative, of being kind of shaped in one's subjectively rather than objectively. Kind of strange in a country where, you know, it was committed to communism and seemingly there was this linear march toward progress. So anyway, this is what kind of brought everything together. And of course, there's the literature on queer temporality, which has many exponents. But the main one I liked was Jack Halberstam's idea, which is the sort of... And this came out originally with Eve Sedgwick in the wake of the AIDS epidemic, or during the AIDS epidemic, where the horizon, the future was cut short. And so people tried to expand and live in the compressed moment, as Jack said. And
right.
So there's the time of and of course, psychoanalysis, throw that in there, right? It's a queer temporality, the analytic session.
Yeah. Well, say more about that. Unpack that. I think that's an interesting idea. What makes it queer?
So psychoanalytic time, of course, there, you know, it's basically nonlinear. Freud first introduced this. It's not, people attribute this to Laplanche, you know, après coup, afterwardness, where a second event retroactively shapes the first event. But of course, it's a very Freudian idea and then Lacanian idea as well. With Nachtschwebligkeit. So there's this idea of retroaction. And all of a sudden being, I think in the analytic session, it can be a sudden awareness of this retroaction and a kind of disruption of linearity. Also because we talk about the past in the present and sometimes they, in an analytic session, they kind of bleed into one another. So when you just, and when you disrupt linear time, you disrupt a lot of things, you know, identity, gender, etc. So there's things kind of break apart and maybe new combinations emerge. And that's in a sense, so it's time and temporality and issues of temporality are very important to psychoanalytic experience, really. And I've heard this from patients, and it's been my own experience in analysis as well. So,
Yeah.
What do you think, Tracy? Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I'm thinking about an essay that I adore called Wasting Time in Analysis. And it's by June Bernstein, and she was an instructor of mine. And one of these essays, an analytic essay. It really makes you laugh because her sense of her grasp of the absurdity of, you know, she begins the essay saying something like, or no, ends the essay something like an epilogue, 1,000 years in a 1,000 years of analysis, and she says something like, being in analysis is a great waste of time, but not being in analysis is an even greater waste of time.
You know? I love it. Yeah.
I mean, you just like and patients come, or ourselves as patients, you know, say like, when is this done? You know, I sometimes think, when might
be done yesterday? They're like, yesterday I was done. Why was am done I here today?
Right. It's back. We're back on again today because I'm not done today, but I was done yesterday. What happened in the passage of time in this 24-hour period? You know, I mean, and sometimes I think that an analysis is all about, right, like getting at, like thinking about time. When is this done? Like, at being such a central question, how much longer do I have to stay here? You know, and like fielding those questions and thinking through those, you know, when patients ask that, there's so much in that. Like working with newer clinicians and like supervising and stuff, it's like the patient says that they think that they should be better by now, and they want to leave. And I said, well, talking about leaving is the absolute centerpiece of the analysis, because it's somehow so animating. Can I leave? And what would happen if I leave? And what would happen to my sense of myself, my sense of time? Am I wasting my time? I mean, patients are, I think I'm wasting my time today. It's like, okay.
I do hear that on occasion. It is absolutely something here. I've wasted the session. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I've wasted the session as if I can know that, because I didn't say anything that made me feel better, or I didn't say anything that I feel like I haven't said here before. You know, welcome to the repetition, which of course is an interesting thing to think about in terms of time, right? Like the repetition.
Right. Well, that's the other aspect, right? There are different temporalities of psychoanalysis. One is retroaction, another is repetition. This idea that, yes, the compulsion to repeat, but we never repeat the same way. There's always a slight, you know, yes, and things accrue, and it's an iterative process, and it's a very slow, painful process as well.
And it takes a lot of time. It takes 1,000 years.
But I'm very attracted. I think that's why I'm attracted to opera. I'm very attracted to these kind of temporalities or experiences of time where things are stretched, and it does feel kind of endless, and there's new things emerge, and you don't have to worry about the fact that it's, you know, a waste. I just want to say this one thing about Elizabeth Freeman, who came up with this idea of chrononormativity. So, and this is where we're so trapped in that so often, where it's capitalist time, you know, how, I don't know how else to say it, but we're on the clock, and it's someone else's clock, and we have to go, and we have to make progress. We have to develop. And so anyway, to disrupt those, and it's historical time, and it's normative time, it's generational time. And sometimes to disrupt this can be quite subversive.
That's right. Yeah. And it's the not, I think, is it on time? David Harvey, not noticing time. I'm trying to remember it. Time as a construct, you know, like it's not even like to even begin to think about time it really stayed with me. Years ago, you said, well, I'm very interested in temporality. And, you know, we both have backgrounds as historians. And I was like, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, how do we think about time? Most of the time, I think I don't have any time. Where's my time? I'm running out of time. This is, you know, this is an anxious time. This is a private time. And there's all these ways in which I, you know, have been paying attention and preparing to speak today, the last like month, you know, it's like this great immersion. I was like thinking about how I'm listening to people talk to me about time and what I'm saying to people about time. And it's kind of sad in a way. Like, I feel like so much of what I hear from people about time is that they don't have it. You know, like, it's like, of course we were having it, but a feeling of not having time. And then there's a little quote that I think I sent you this song, which I, of course, preparing for an interview, everything becomes about the interview, you know, and if things are going well. And I found this song by Lou Reed, and it's called Turning Time Around. And it's so beautiful. I want to share it here, a little bit of it here, and a little bit of with for you and for the listeners, because it touched me. I'm not going to sing it because I'm not Lou Reed. But anyway, she says, what do you call love? Well, I call it Harry. Oh, please, I'm being serious. What do you call love? Well, I don't call it family. And I don't call it lust. I think he's saying this to Laurie Anderson. And as we all know, marriage isn't a must. And I suppose in the end, it's a matter of trust. If I had to, I'd call love time. It fills me up with some, you know, and then there's another line. And when you're in love, you don't have to ask. There's never enough time to hold love in your grasp. My time is your time when you're in love. And time is what you never have enough of. You can't see it or hold it. It is exactly like love. I was like, whoa. I don't know.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of idea of love as time, and I think he means that maybe the progression of time as opposed to time in suspension, which is right. The way that love can be idealized is like, especially young love, where time stops and the two lovers are, that's the, you know, this is the depiction, right?
Yeah.
But it's not really about that, is it?
No. It's correct. But it was just so, I was like, love and time and giving the experience, right. The experience of young love and young love over time. It just got so and I'd never heard the song before, you know, but I was like, what's this? Somehow I was talking to somebody.
I thought you were going to play the song.
But oh, I'm going to play a song at the very end.
Oh, okay. Oh my God. No, okay.
Kidding, but I thought at the end it's better because, well, let's not give it away. But anyway, there will be a song. I won't be singing it. It might sound a little funny. I guess I'm thinking about one of the things that struck me about your essay, and I was thinking about people waiting on lines and the queue and the sense of course it becomes a queer time because there's in a way a queer sensibility is like, and to my mind is always an embrace of like the absurd, Like, here we are standing in line waiting for our, you know, whatever, our food, our this, our that. And the way in which when I'm on a line, I end up having conversations with strangers, right? If you're waiting on a long line, it sort of creates, and everybody's frustrated and you're managing these really difficult feelings of frustration and wasted time. And I was like, there's something that lends itself to sort of a, like almost a camp, like a camp, you know, it's like it, things get, I don't know. I just was thinking like, it's a very sort of campy moment where people are online and they're very satirical and they're very, you know, say crazy things to each other on the line, you know, when you're sort of stuck in time with others, not knowing when you're going to be like, I experience this in Italy all the time. Oh my God, where all you do is wait online. Yeah. It's like, increasingly
in New York, we're waiting in line, but there's all kinds of lines, right? There's a line. I was thinking about the rush ticket line or to get concert tickets or to get opera tickets. And then people get to share their fandom and get to talk about productions. And, you know, it's been, Wayne Kestenbaum wrote about cruising on the opera ticket, rush ticket line. And of course he would. I'm like, why does this ever happen to me? You know, like, how come I never saw this? So there's this. And, but the idea is in the case of, like, I talk about late socialism and it became such a standard kind of, it became such a daily experience. And often you would just line up for the sake of lining up. You would see a line, you don't know what it's for, but it must be something important. So you would line up because it's an economy of scarcity. Maybe it was like this during COVID at moments, I don't know. But so people, you line up, you don't know why, and then things can emerge. Surprising things can happen. Situational intimacies can occur. So this is, and I think this is what part of what you were talking about, Trace. And there is a kind of campy aspect, right? But I think surprises. And I even, again, to bring it back to psychoanalysis, I think that there's something in the analytic session as the analysand is talking, it almost mimics this because, you know, others' speech enters your speech, you tell stories, and before you know it, you know, things just... this is what free associating is. Something pops up and it's a complete surprise. Why did I think of that? You know, what happened right, there?
Right. Where did that? I'm so surprised I said that. I didn't know that I thought that. There's a sense of sort of run, like wait, you come into analysis and you are just waiting on the line, time on the line and seeing what emerges in the little spate of time. I just switched the time actually for my patients. I just moved, not everyone, but almost, I'm slowly moving people to 45 minute sessions. I've done 50 minute sessions forever because that's what was done to me. And I recently am experiencing an analytic session myself that's 45 minutes. I'm like such a copycat. I do whatever my analyst does. Oh, okay. I'm down to 45 minutes.
They must be angry. They lost 5 minutes.
some of them have lost. Yeah, I'm slowly working my way through, and people are losing their, you know, the 5 minutes. I'm introducing the idea. Of course, I'm waiting for, you know, what feels like a right moment in people's treatments to like say it because it's not so crucial. But I'm listening to what my patients have to say about this feeling of having lost some time. Mostly, though, they seem to kind of like it, that it's like not this, like, you've ripped me off 5 minutes. But, I mean, some patients have said, so am I going to get a discount? You know, no.
Yeah. Right. No
discount. I'll just have more time in between sessions to pee and, you know, do the things.
And to think about you.
Right. And to think about you and then, right. And that New York Times thing on therapy, just like, what do therapists do in the 5 minutes in between, oh my God, in between sessions, you know. But I've experienced time a little bit differently. Like without the extra 5 minutes myself, I feel the difference. And I'm like, okay, I'm a little more, I'm a little more nimble or something, like things are coming forth. Like there's a little more, there's a little pressure. And it has been perhaps a little bit productive, you know, but I mean, there's, you know, is psychoanalysis, what's his name? Adrian Johnson, something about psychoanalysis is a discourse on the subject's relationship to temporality, right? I was like, yeah, that's, I like that. I think that that's just sort of a, something I think about a lot.
I mean, if you can reach back into the past and then make links to the present, isn't this what the work is?
What about, you know, like I was thinking about the different schools of analytic thought and, you know, like the here and now, right? People who are really working here and now versus people who, like, someone said to me recently, well, should I take a history of the patient? And I said, well, you could, you know, but you could also just, my idea would be that the patient will show you their history in the first session by how they show up, what they say, how they hold themselves, where they look, you know, you get the history right there. And, you know, versus, you know, other schools of thought really take very seriously, like, you know, let's get the history, and they'll spend several sessions. Right. And I mean, yeah.
Some Lacanians are very, maybe surprisingly, are very committed to that.
To history. Yeah.
Yeah. To the history in the beginning, to figure out the signifiers, where they are, where the nodal points are for the patient. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kind of a map that structures the analysis later. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it's like sort of reaching for the imaginary right away. It's like, okay, tell me your history, and it's like, oh, and, you know, at the same time that it could sort of, you know, collapse some free association and a different use of time. I mean, because some patients come in with their history, you know, they have their history and they like to talk about their history very unfreely.
Yes, you know, right. It's the same story they've told. Yeah. Over and over.
Yeah. And now it's my time to hear it. Yeah,
exactly. But it's, you know, yeah, right. The idea is to transform it, obviously, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about childhood. And I mean, since you've done this book on, you know, the queerness of childhood, I think it would be interesting to hear about, like, what is queer about childhood? I mean, what when you guys were putting this book of essays together, from many different, you know, thinkers, what is queer about childhood? Is childhood queer? Why queer it? Why not?
You know? I mean, one way to approach this question is to think about the fact that, I mean, immediately what jumps out is that childhood is a retroactive creation. Children never think about themselves as children, or they do, but they don't think about their childhood. Childhood is something that adults dreamt up. And when does childhood end? And this idea of a beginning and an end, and how you're supposed to kind of in increments approach something that is, let's say, sexual maturity or the ability to, you know, to be in to use money, to work, all the things that have been held in suspension. But then you're supposed to kind of never enter those things as a child. And yet you're supposed to keep moving closer. And how do you manage this? So it's the time of delay. I mean, this is what, you know, some theorists have put forward. It's a time of delay, but you don't want to delay it too much or too little. You know, this is a very difficult problem. And also, you know, the way that psychoanalysis thinks about childhood, it started with Freud in three essays or earlier. And there are two ways of thinking about it: developmentally and as something that, and polymorphously perverse. So, you know, you're either moving along a timeline and everything is linear and you go from one phase to another, from the oral to the anal to the phallic to the Oedipal to the genital, whatever it is, right? So, But the other way of thinking about it is that there's this polymorphous perversity that never really goes away. And we all have this kind of tendency to stray, to delay, to go in various directions. And Catherine Stockton, you know, writes about this, and she's often quoted in the volume.
Yeah. She did the epilogue, didn't she, for the book, I think.
She did the epilogue, correct.
Yeah, the final chapter. I really like her. Very, very, I don't know, something about her writing just strikes me as very free. how she phrases things, what she feels free to say. It was pretty enlivening. Ending.
I just want to say too that she sort of queered childhood. She wrote from as a queer theorist about childhood, and I think Freud did it before her. But I think this was a seminal work in queer theory, and it was maybe one of the first times that there were other people who did this, but the queer theory took seriously. They didn't just treat children as this like normative, like Lee Edelman did. As something we have to kind of avoid if we want to be real queers and if we want to avoid the normative and not to be trapped in this sort of like children are the future, blah, blah, so that was his line. She said, no, but children are the queerest, creatures.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're strangers, right? It's like constantly thinking like, well, you've just given birth to a stranger. I mean, the reluctance of, right? Well, and that's pretty queer, but it's like accepting like, well, I'm now giving birth to a stranger who I have to get to know. And of course, I don't like that idea. So I assume that this stranger is really like me. And yet, kid grows up and remains at some level, their own wild animal of sorts. Have you read what's her name? I'm going to say her last name incorrectly. She's British. Lisa Baritzer, I think it is. An Enduring Time. Have you gotten ever? Excuse me. That's my long COVID. Just a minute. No joke. Seriously. I think that's what it is. It's weird. But anyway, living with it, living with it over time. She's tries to build a relationship, like she's critiquing Edelman and trying to build the relationship between the death drive, right, which Edelman really, kind of, as I understand his thinking, is sort of the centerpiece of his work, No Future. And she's trying to link up maternal time, which is the time of repetition, the time of do it again, and building a bridge between the two, which I thought was, kind of productive, but yeah, her book is really, it's interesting, Anna, in that it's about time that doesn't move. It's about maintaining, remaining, sustaining. It's kind of like, like a John Cage recording of like, the street as music, it's like, okay, she's trying to capture this time that goes deeply unaccounted for. But one of her and the book is sort of depressing in a way, because she reminds us again and again, and I wonder what you think about this, but she says talking about development, she says it's, the future, a future as development has shifted, the idea of development in the future has shifted psychologically, become emptied of its affective qualities. This is a quote from her, such as hope, anticipation, longing, or the promise of satisfaction and betterment. The future will come for some, she writes, but it will bring no fulfillment on the promises of the now. So it's like this book about like how, what made me think about like Halberstam does ask the question, what's the relationship between, sort of gender transitivity, transgenderism in relationship to postmodern understandings of time and space. And, sort of, which both of these sort of ideas are, but they're rich. I mean, I'd like to have more time I do think that
maybe it's about the breaking down of linear time, because the more, you know, when linear time, again, when it breaks down or it gets disrupted, so does identity, because identity or the self, what we think about as the self, is constructed in time and in a kind of progression. And I mean, this is the novel, this is the autobiography, this is, so when there's something like COVID, you know, a pandemic, or there are events, traumatic, catastrophic, or maybe just, you know, something quite personal that disrupts one's idea about time, I think it can be quite actually productive for the person. It doesn't have to be this kind of despairing abyss, or at least this was the original, Jack's original idea. And this kind of, I mean, it's kind of, I hate to say this because it's like, it's a little bit facile here, but it's like this YOLO kind of stuff. Like, yeah, sorry, that was a bad association. I strike that from the record. Maybe you can edit that out.
We don't edit anything here, as you know. So
I actually do know that.
I don't have the time. Because I don't have enough time to do that.
Things have changed. Now you edit and post. I guess you don't. Okay.
No, there's still no editing. People ask, but they can ask all they want. But we say, no, we don't have the time. Because we don't have the means. We don't have the time. And, you know, time is of the essence. So we're sorry. Just, you know, just hold your tongue if you think you might say something you don't want to be.
yeah.
To be available for the rest of time.
I mean, exactly.
It's like, yeah, and here we are doing this on Memorial Day, talking about time, you know, giving our time. Here we are.
Yeah.
So I don't know anything, you know, else you want to say, because we, you know, we have another whatever. We have a little bit of time left, and we have a song we're going to do. Anything that, like, what are you working on now? I'd like to ask you that, because I know that there's something that you're working on.
Do
you want to talk?
I'm writing a kind of, it's, I would rather kind of keep it shrouded in mystery, but I think
before you answer, I want to make sure you want to say this. So just take a moment, take a little time.
Yeah, I'm going to frame it as, it's somewhat autobiographical, but also very, it's a meditation on mourning and about loss. And very personal loss, but also loss of a country, now loss of two countries in a way, because I'm originally from Ukraine, and I studied Russia for a long time. And so I weave together various losses, personal, political, bodily, etc., and think about it analytically.
That's sad.
Yeah. What does it mean to think about it that way?
Mm-hmm. No. I was actually, thank you for giving us a little peek, and that's great. And I'm sure people will be excited to and look forward to reading what you write. One of the things that you say in the piece that really was haunting to me was sort of a sense of like the death of the Soviet Union produced a kind of melancholy, and that this is a quote, the late socialist child did not grow up. I was like, what? I, you know, it was new to me, right? I mean, okay, I'm not, you know, I'm not a person who's, you know, knows her Russian history, but, and about the loss of a country that no longer exists. I mean, it was really, I don't know. I appreciated reading your piece because it helped me to put something together that I kind of knew but didn't know about sort of the Soviet Union and the, you know, like all of these, there was the future change, the past change, what you could hold on to. And you know about this very well. And I don't know, it just was just very thought provoking. The late socialist child did not grow up.
Yeah, I mean, there was also a utopia and the idea of utopia, and the child is a kind of repository of all of these hopes and utopian dreams. And there were all kinds of socialist rituals that revolved around children, young pioneers, the Komsomol, the, you know, these youth movements. A lot of people that very nostalgically remember their Soviet childhoods. They seem, you know, sort of idyllic, and it's strange to then integrate that. If you're a refugee like me, you came here as an immigrant, as a refugee, and what do you do with this childhood? You see yourself dressed up in, you know, there's a portrait of Lenin behind you. You're like in this folk Ukrainian outfit, reciting a poem about socialism. And this is absolutely bizarre to a lot of Americans.
Yeah. Well, me being one of them, right? I was like, wow, yeah, that was, it was as if, in fact, I think my, you know, American upbringing was that there were no children in the Soviet Union. I think that was kind of a message that I had gotten, that there weren't children. They were other than children. They were small people, yes, but was there a childhood there? And I kind of recall part of Cold War anti-communist culture, putting forth the idea that you know, people in the Soviet Union had been robbed of childhood, and instead you bring to us this how do you say Goloboy?
Goloboy Shchenok. Yeah, it's a blue.
It's beautiful. Yeah, these sort of like artifacts from your childhood, and their importance to you, and also their sort of queer, you know, containing sort of queer messages. Why do I have to be so blue? Goloboy is blue. And Goloboy also, you say in the article, is a word to indicate homosexuality, queerness, gayness.
Yeah. It was primarily in the 80s that it became very widely used to say, you know, gay. It's basically a word for gay. It's like saying, "Goloboy." It's not the nicest. It's not exactly derogatory, but it was appropriated. So, it's a difficult word, and I think it kind of. I'm not sure it's still kind of used now, but it was definitely of a certain era, and so it was weird to me that this cartoon was about a misfit puppy. And his coat was blue, and so this is the main. And then he finds a companion. Yeah, he finds a companion, another a sailor, actually.
Perfect.
I'm saying there has to be some connotation there. It cannot. I mean, I can't prove it, but my God. You know.
What are you doing running around with that sailor?
Yes.
Your blue fur, etc. So, well, listen, I do have to bring us to a close, and I am gonna just like try to see if I can make something work. I've never done this with a song, but I have it on my. I sent it to myself, and I think it's gonna work. So hold on one second, everybody, because I want to leave us with a song.
Goodbye now.
Well, no, just wait one sec. Let's. Is it telling me? Right. Is it? Yeah, we're getting close. Okay, is it? All right, don't play. Oh my God. Carol Burnett. And then she would say, holding her ear, good night, everybody. Anyway, I just wanted to share that with the listeners. And I just, I'm really glad we've had this time together, Anna, you and I. Yeah, it's really just great to hear you speak. And I always learn from you and you're erudite. You really are. So I value that. And I just want to say goodbye to everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned and, you know, to other interviews and other interviewers. The channel continues, and we'll bring you a lot to listen to. And I'll let you know somehow if I pull a more irreverent and fun, witty and absurd, psychoanalytically oriented.
Thank you, Tracy.
Okay, love you, Anna. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.